Okay, so let's get going this morning. So we got one more seminar next week. So this is the second to last one. Happy Thanksgiving. Okay, so this morning we've got Christian Torgerson, who is a research landscape ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey and also a faculty member here in the college, an assistant professor. And his education is that he received a B.A. in 1993 in geography from the University of Oregon, an M.S. in 1996, and a Ph.D. in 2002 in fishery science from Oregon State University. So he's definitely Oregonian. But it's okay.
True, it's okay. You'll still
and,
let me speak.
His field of expertise and specialty is ecology and spatial analysis of riverine landscapes. And this morning he's going to tell us about cold water fissures and thermal refuges in hot water. Christian.
Thank you, Bob. Good morning. Do we typically dim the light a little bit? I've got a bunch of slides for you this morning, and I kind of weighted them towards lots of imagery. Recognizing that in the morning you're not ready to digest a lot of heavy-duty statistics. So I've got a lot of slides. I'm going to go through them and sort of point out the key points. And then I'll try to leave questions for the end. I know you folks have to be leaving at 9:20, so I'll try to wrap it up. I'll be going through the slides relatively quickly. And don't try to get every detail of them. I think after you hear the whole talk, you'll kind of get the gist of the theme of cold water refuges and sort of this important issue that's become ever more important, I think, in the management of aquatic systems, particularly with all the concern about climate change. So to start out with, I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors, Joe Ebersole. There are a bunch of slides in here that he gave me from some of his work. He's in the EPA in Corvallis, Oregon, and also Drew Keenan. The three of us are writing a report that should come out, I don't know, sometime early in 2009 that summarizes sort of a conceptual framework for identifying, quantifying, and restoring thermal refugia in Pacific Northwest rivers. So that's something you can kind of keep an eye out for. Also, we had a symposium at the Western Division American Fisheries Society meeting in, I guess it was last May, and there are a bunch of talks online that you can look at. If you just type in Torgerson cold water refuges in Google, it should probably pop right up. And there, it's all on video, and it's a really good way to kind of get more information on this topic, including the political aspects, the regulatory aspects, and then, of course, all the ecology and biology. I also want to acknowledge a lot of the other people that have contributed to this work. We certainly did not do it alone. I'm not going to list them all, obviously, but if there are probably people there whom you know. And, of course, I'd really like to recognize all of the field crews who helped us collect these data. Typically, the streams that I've worked in are wilderness streams. They're in rugged, remote areas like the Crooked River or the wildernesses of northeastern Oregon, and these folks really risked life and limb to collect these data. So this story starts out, actually, when I was doing my master's work with Hiram Lee. So we've been doing this for a fairly long time. And we made some very simple observations that were intriguing. And for some reason, I think there's this natural appeal that cold water refugia have. I think it's because a lot of us are fisher people at heart, and we want to know where those fish are and to sort of be able to predict on the landscape or in a given pool where there will be fish. There's some sort of natural draw to it. So here's a photograph of the Middle Fork of the John Day River. Here's a cool tributary entering the main stem of the Middle Fork. And here is a pretty large rainbow trout, about this long. And this is an observation that that I made, and we had made other similar observations of fish behaving in a very strange manner using habitat that's really not that optimal. You can see there's not a lot of cover here, but as it turns out, there's thermal heterogeneity, or thermal variation in this stream that's causing this fish to select this particular area. But the story was not quite that simple. Although we might see these thermal refuges and realize how important they are, we also recognize that, you know, there's something wrong here. Obviously, if this fish let me put a thermometer right next to it, there's sort of an issue here. So a lot of these fishes, when they're using thermal refuges, are basically just trying to stay alive. It doesn't mean that they've used these little pockets of cool water to exist and thrive. It's really kind of this theme of, you know, a refuge is not a home. If you think of these fish as refugees, that'll kind of give you a feel for, you know, what we're talking about here. This kind of behavior is really a representative of fish literally holding on at the very edge of their thermal and physiological tolerances. Similarly, when we started to look at spring Chinook salmon, obviously this species is of concern throughout the Columbia River Basin. This kind of behavior was not normal. Literally, we were kind of just lying in the grass right here, and the salmon would come up and just kind of hang with their nose right in this cold water. Again, not an optimal place, not a lot of cover. So these fish are making trade-offs. But we also observed that, you know, although this is, you know, in a way it's, you know, scientifically very appealing and simplistic, it really doesn't happen that often. You can understand why. If all salmon in the Middle Fork of the John Day River had to be using habitat like this to survive, they probably wouldn't be there anymore. So this kind of behavior, although interesting scientifically, it really is not that common. And when we tried to, we actually put radio tags in these fish that were temperature sensitive, we found that they weren't using this kind of small-scale thermal heterogeneity very much. And this sort of raised a lot of questions. And in this talk, I'm going to address a number of different themes about thermal refuges. And what role they play in salmonid ecology in particular as cold water fishes. Also, how do we identify these thermal refuge habitats? This is really important for management agencies. Obviously, they want to know where these cold water pockets are and how they can protect them and restore them. You know, how do we, can we predict their distribution? You know, obviously, you can't walk through an entire stream and count all these thermal refuge habitats. It's really labor intensive, but can we predict their distribution based on broad scale hydrology and geomorphology? And finally, once we've identified them and identified their ecological importance, how can we protect them and restore them in degraded rivers? So I talked about scale, and that's a real common theme in a lot of my research. And like any aquatic habitat variable, water temperature varies a lot depending upon the scale at which you observe it. And just in a general sense, we know that temperature varies at the sort of the watershed scale. We've got cold streams and we've got warm streams. So you can think of that as a first level at which temperature varies across the landscape, okay, among watersheds. We pretty much understand this pretty well. We also understand that, you know, at the fine scale, like I showed the pictures of the Chinook and the rainbow trout, we kind of know what drives thermal heterogeneity at this fine scale, literally where a fish might be with its nose in a tributary junction with where there's cold water. But we don't really understand this, what we call the intermediate scale. And this is sort of where reaches might be relatively cooler, like a spawning habitat reach or reaches along the main stem. We've got this little helicopter here. I'll talk more about that. So you kind of have to employ different methods to identify thermal heterogeneity at these intermediate scales. And a lot of the work, as I mentioned, that I've done has been in northeastern Oregon. It's applicable to places like eastern Washington, particularly in the Yakima River and the Toucanon. But a lot of this work did occur in the North Fork of the John Day River. This is a wilderness stream. So that's kind of our cold stream example. And also the Winnaha River right here up near the border. Another cold stream, but
It doesn't have the land use history that the Wenaha or the North Fork of the John Day does. It's a very pristine system, and I always tell people it's probably one of the most pristine systems in Oregon and Washington. It's a fantastic, beautiful wilderness river system. And then finally, as a contrast, we studied Chinook salmon distribution in the Middle Fork of the John Day, which at the time was heavily grazed. Now a lot of this land has been purchased by the Nature Conservancy, is now being managed by the Warm Springs Tribe. And this whole environment is rapidly changing, and now we actually have the opportunity to design restoration projects that can actually increase thermal heterogeneity. So it's kind of a dream come true for me as a scientist to have studied these systems in a degraded state and then be able to contribute scientific knowledge to their restoration. So again, the theme of this talk is going to be scales and how temperature varies across multiple scales. We'll start with this microhabitat scale, or the channel unit scale. That's really how temperature varies within an individual pool or riffle. And these are the techniques that we typically use. These are fast response temperature probes. They're usually on a telescoping fishing rod. And they enable you to just walk quickly latitudinally across the stream and longitudinally and map thermal heterogeneity just by looking at the digital readout on the thermometer that changes very rapidly. And so you can identify these potential areas where there might be cool water. And Joe Ebersol, my colleague, longtime colleague, has written an interesting paper that quantifies and sort of builds a typology for thermal variation at this fine scale. And so these are some general types of cold water refuges that you might see. This is called a lateral seep. This is an example where you might see one. So you can see increased porosity in the gravel bar here. Flow is from top to bottom. And this is where you might expect to see a little pocket of cool water. Again, these are not huge pockets, but fish do respond to them, as you saw in that photo. Another type of cold water refuge is the cold spring brook. These are really interesting and not that common in a lot of the rivers that have been degraded, because many of our rivers have been channelized and straightened, so you lose a lot of the complexity, particularly in sinuosity, that creates these spring brook habitats. And you can see, notice the difference in vegetation. Those are some of the clues that there's cold water entering here. And what's happening is there's subsurface flow upstream, and it's then emerging into this side channel. So there is actually no connection upstream for a spring brook. It's literally coming out of the ground and then entering the main stem here. These are not optimal habitat usually, because in order for a fish to use them, they have to move up into that area where they're relatively exposed to predation. Then we've got cold alcoves. These are a little more common. This is a good photograph of one. So here's the flow direction, and I believe it's this direction in the photograph. So you can see the water is coming down here. It's similar to the spring brook, but there's actually all the water subsurface here. And this usually it's larger in volume, larger in area, and these are used more frequently by fish because they can move in and out of the main stem. So at the next scale, you know, I described how we know a lot about temperature variation at the fine scale, and we also know a lot about it at the coarse scale. Well, typically at sort of the network and basin level, it's relatively easy to quantify thermal variation with these. You're probably familiar with some of these. Some of you have worked in management agencies. These are hobo temps or continuously logging data loggers. And you can just put these throughout a stream network. And we generally know that, you know, at a coarse scale, it's going to be cooler at the headwaters and warmer downstream. And some folks in NOAA have really done a great job of combining a lot of the temperature data logger information for entire basins, which is really important. Typically, a management agency has enough money to put a couple loggers here, a couple loggers there, and then there's not a lot of coordination among agencies. So everybody has this little piecemeal picture of temperature, and we need to coordinate those more so we can get a better picture. This is what some of the folks, Carol Volk in NOAA, actually did, and they brought together a lot of these data. So you can see, you know, generally the headwaters are cooler. Water is generally cooler in this part. This is the North Fork. It's a bit higher elevation than down here in the main stem, and then
as you can see, as you get farther down, it's warmer. So we know a lot about temperature variation at that scale. But we don't understand really even how thermal refuges are distributed at these reach level scales. And that, to imagine, you know, what I mean by reach level, that's usually around 10 kilometers or so. So the temperature will vary over maybe 10 kilometers. Those are features that influence that are broad scale geomorphic and valley level landscape characteristics. So in order to do that, you have to cover a lot of ground. And so one of the things that I did a lot more of in the past, I'm not doing so much of it these days, is flying over the streams using a thermal imager and mapping surface water temperature. Now, the thermal imager does just measure the surface, but these are shallow streams, and there's good mixing. So obviously you don't want to try to use this technique in a river where there's a lot of thermal stratification. But this is sort of a graphic depiction of what I mean by thermal variation at the reach scale. This is distance upstream, and this is temperature in degrees C. And this black line here shows the surface temperature of the Middle Fork of the John Day as you're going upstream. So you can see there's variation within those reaches, but there's also variation among them. And these sort of broad-scale peaks and troughs are things that really hadn't been described before because people hadn't put data loggers in the stream at a density high enough to resolve those kinds of patterns. These other dots just show the thermal variation in the tributary mouth. So here's a tributary entering at approximately 75 kilometers upstream, and it's this temperature. So you can see the temperature at the tributary mouths also is very variable. The red dots just show ground truth control points where we actually had a data logger in the water and we're comparing it to the thermal imagery. So this is the technique, and it's really important because it gives you an idea for how that temperature varies at the broader scale. And this is a map of showing temperature variation in the Middle Fork. Same kind of information, but just showing it at a map level. And it's useful to look at it in this manner because you can really see the multi-scale approach. So within this river, you can identify a relatively cool reach. Note the yellow colors are cooler than the red. This is the coldest. But you can identify a relatively cool reach. And then within that reach, you can look at it in more detail, looking at the thermal imagery. And you can see this is the stream in yellow. And then the land is in gray tones and red. These red areas just show increased soil moisture. That's where the surface of the ground is cooler because there's some sort of subsurface water moving through this system. But again, emphasizing that multi-scale approach, you can then zoom in further and identify thermal variation at the channel unit scale. Now, as I mentioned before, this level of thermal heterogeneity, literally at this channel unit scale, these are the locations of the Chinook that we had tagged with radio transmitters. This was not as common as we thought it would be. Naturally, we just sort of assume that that's the appropriate scale of thermal behavioral thermal regulation by the fish, but it's natural to assume that because that's the scale that we perceive it as humans. When we walk up to the bank, that's what we see, but what we don't see is this level of thermal variation. This is the same plot that I showed you earlier, but it's just color-coded to show you reaches that are warmer than the median temperature in red and reaches that are cooler than the median temperature of that reach in blue. And it just sort of highlights that these are reach-scale thermal refugia. And when we compare the temperature pattern, again, this is distance upstream temperature. I'm going to skip this panel for a second. This is the distribution of adult spring Chinook salmon. You can see that the highest peaks in salmon abundance are lined up with these cold water areas. But that's not alone. I mean, the only factor that's influencing their distribution. This is also the number of pools per kilometer. So we used a statistical model to compare these associations. But again, this is the scale at which behavioral thermal regulation occurred
And that was somewhat novel. Nobody had really described thermal patterns and the response by fishes at that scale. And we also learned some interesting things that we didn't expect this reach that was heavily grazed at the time and pretty degraded, as you can see there. Thumb jetties here and the banks are collapsing. We didn't expect that reach to be actually one of the coolest reaches, but it was. And that's because this was the alluvial valley reach that had a very sinuous channel pattern. It was much more complex. Even after it had been grazed for 100 years, it still had that capacity to support subsurface flow. So it's pretty interesting. Again, this is not what that river looks like anymore. It's phenomenal. It's recovering very quickly. So I talked about a very simple response of a single species to thermal heterogeneity, particularly at the reach scale. In this next part of the talk, I'm going to talk about something a little more complex, and that is the response of the fish assemblage. In other words, all the species, because this is really important. The fish are not out there alone, and an adult Chinook is existing in a whole different world from a stickleback or a chisel mouth or a long-nosed dace. An adult Chinook doesn't have to eat. It doesn't compete with any other fish. It's the largest fish there. It essentially rules the roost. They can be wherever they want to be. But it becomes a lot more complex when you've got multiple species that you're looking at because they interact, they compete, and you know, in some cases they prey on one another. So an example, and this is just one. I was trying to keep my talk short. I've got other examples from the Middle Fork, but the Crooked River is a really interesting place to think about temperature. Just out of curiosity, who's been to the Crooked River in Oregon? Just a few. It's a phenomenal place. I highly recommend that you go there. It's very famous for whitewater boating. Not so famous for fishing, although it used to be. But this is a system. Note, this is the reach that I'm going to be showing you data for. It's in a very arid system, high desert. You see these green areas? Those are not naturally green. irrigation is a big deal here. So there's a lot of concern in this particular river about extracting groundwater and then evaluating the potential effects of fish. Well, this system, it flows through a basalt, a flood basalt canyon. And what's really interesting about it is there are groundwater springs just literally gushing from the walls of this canyon. It is phenomenal. It's the most interesting place I've ever seen to study thermal heterogeneity. So it's sort of like floating down a river in Hawaii. You're in the middle of a desert, but there are ferns and all this green vegetation just sort of coming off the cliff sides. It's a phenomenal place. Very unusual. There's a book that's called A Peculiar River, and this is written by some folks. And the Crooked River is a very peculiar river, and I'll describe why. Here's an example of this rugged canyon. Again, I take my hat off to all the crew members on this one because there's essentially no access to this canyon but in the headwaters or upstream and then downstream. So it was quite an effort to collect data there, but this riverscape approach that I'll describe for evaluating fish response to thermal heterogeneity is one that I think it's fairly unique because it involves this multi-staged effort where you start with thermal airborne thermal remote sensing to get overall patterns in water temperature. And then you typically have to do some sort of reconnaissance. In this case, we did it with kayaks to evaluate what it's going to be like to snorkel through these entire whitewater reaches and figure out how we're going to logistically get through the system and be able to get out in time before it's dark. Because although this is pretty a wide area, that you can't even camp there, really. So that's the next step. And then you use snorkeling, continuous snorkeling, where you literally snorkel the entire, in this case, about 10 miles, and you map the habitat in every pool and riffle, and you try to map the distribution of fish. In this river, we couldn't quite do that because we were limited by time, so we did subsample. But and then what we also did is used electrofishing at a
a select number of sites because snorkeling is not good for identifying the benthic species, the ones that are more cryptic, and they like sculpins and dace, things that are typically on the bottom of the stream and they're hiding from you. Rainbow trout and whitefish and suckers, for the most part, are pretty easy to see. And then finally, we also used angling in some places as well, so it was sort of a combined electrofishing. The problem with electrofishing is you can only use it in the water that's shallow enough, so along the edges. So they're not perfect methods, but seeing as nobody had ever done this before, we had to just do what we could. And you can't get in there with block nets, and it's a big river. So
I'm always a great fan of collecting data that nobody has ever collected before in places that are somewhat unusual and difficult to access, because then you're the first one to collect the data. It's always quite interesting. So I'll just describe the method. Here's again the map of the reach that we studied. This is upstream going downstream. There's a little bit of BLM land here, but it's most of it is private. This is the location of the Crooked River Basin. So the first approach is, again, just snorkeling literally the whole reach, floating downstream with waterproof backpacks and a GPS and those sorts of things, and recording on waterproof booklets. And then electrofishing is sort of the, it's not the light and fast technique, as many of you know. It's really hard to get down to the system. So these were the only places where we could actually access the river through these steep canyon trails. And so the snorkeling efforts usually occurred from here to here in a day, essentially, because we couldn't camp. But in these locations, we used fishing or angling and electrofishing to get a feel for the overall variation in fish assemblage structure that we couldn't identify using snorkeling. And then we also, at those same sites, collected data on water quality, pH, turbidity, and conductivity. The Crooked River is not the it's not the easiest river to snorkel because there's really high turbidity in the upper portion, and I'll explain why shortly. And then it gets better as you go downstream. And then this is an example of using the thermal imaging to identify thermal heterogeneity. I just have this little image here, and you can see there's a shadow on the canyon here, but this is one of those large cold water seeps coming into the system. The river here is about 20 meters wide, and then here are some other little cool pockets. So it's a really interesting area to study fish distribution in relation to thermal heterogeneity. So here we go. So now we can talk about why the Crooked River is such a peculiar river. First of all, let's look at temperature. In this middle panel, this is the temperature profile from forward-looking infrared imaging, and this is distance upstream, okay? And note that the river is getting warmer as you go upstream. Now, how common is that? I don't know a lot of rivers that get warmer as you go upstream. And that's because I think that the river increases in volume at least by 50, I can't remember, maybe more. I can't remember the statistics, but at least by 50%, maybe 100% as it goes downstream, because all that water is coming in somewhere around here. All that groundwater is just gushing in and increasing flow and decreasing water temperature. And also, as you get all this clear spring water coming in, the turbidity decreases as you go downstream. So it's like a river sort of turned on its head, which is really interesting. I'll explain some of the other features in this graph. This is just the 7-day average daily max temperature, so you can see these are from data loggers. Obviously, the river is cool down here, and then it gradually gets warmer in upstream direction. This is conductivity. Similarly, as you go upstream, your conductivity increases because you've got a lot of pollutants, actually, and things coming down from the headwater portions. That's actually, we don't want to go into that. That's a little more complex now, but this is essentially a signature that's the result of all the groundwater coming in. pH decreases dramatically as you go upstream.
And then I talked about turbidity. See this? This is what the river looked like in some places. Really hard to see in snorkeling. That's why we needed to use angling and electrofishing. But here's the pattern of turbidity in that system. So, secchi distance. That's just the distance that you could see underwater. And it's really high as you go downstream, and then it decreases as you go upstream. And turbidity, of course, increases as you go upstream.
So that's sort of the water quality template in the background. Remember I mentioned that we mapped all of the habitat there, too, all the pools, all the ripples. And what was interesting is you can see it's pretty variable. We've got a lot of glide habitats, which are somewhere in between a riffle and a pool, in this portion of the system and here. Riffles, it's faster water up here, which is interesting. And that makes sense. As you go farther upstream, typically the gradient increases. But it's faster water here, lots of more pools here. And so there's this interaction between the physical habitat and the temperature that the fish are responding to. So you kind of have to take those into account. Now, this is a pretty simple example because the temperature decreases as you go downstream are so pronounced. These are the longitudinal patterns of the fishes. So starting with rainbow trout, which is a cold water fish, as you go upstream, the distribution of this species decreases dramatically. Essentially, they just appear in the system in the greatest numbers right where all that groundwater is coming in. And again, it's a river turned up on its head. Normally, if you're going fishing, you think, oh, I'm going to go fishing for rainbow trout. I'm going to fish for them in the headwaters. Not the case here. You'd have to go a lot farther in the headwaters of the Crooked River to find trout. Mountain whitefish is sort of a cool water species. Again, a similar kind of pattern with their abundance being greatest downstream. Northern pike minnow, which is a large predatory minnow or cyprinid, it's a native species. They're actually pretty patchy, and it's interesting. Generally, they're not as common downstream, but their distribution is not quite as predictable based on temperature, and that kind of makes sense. This is a river where the trout are kind of on the margin of their thermal tolerances. The warm water species are essentially winning the battle of competition for food in this river. And then just unidentified cyprinids or minnows. Those are all the species, chisel mouth and red side shiner and those sorts of things. The species that we couldn't really identify in the snorkel surveys just because it's kind of hard to see. Again, they have a really pronounced pattern of increasing in relative abundance as you go upstream. And all of these responses at the broad scale are in direct relation to the groundwater inputs. Now, there's sort of an interesting wrinkle in this story, and this really surprised us. And it got us thinking about how fish might be using thermal heterogeneity at a finer scale in this system. So here are a series of graphs for pike minnow and rainbow trout. Some of you may know these as red band. There's sort of a controversy about whether there is a real red band or not. I just call them rainbow trout. They have the same genus and species. Red band is more of a romantic term, I think, because they're thought to occur in these areas. So these are the two species. This is the cold water species. This is the warm water species. We can actually look at the size of these fish and how it changed as you go upstream in the system. So at the top, rainbow trout, believe it or not, the average size of the rainbow trout and weight, length and weight, increased as they went upstream. So the fish are getting bigger, the average size, I should say, of the fish increases as you go upstream. Northern pike minnow, the average size decreases as you go upstream towards the warm water. So it was sort of contrary to what we thought. What is wrong here? Well, what it is if you're a large rainbow trout, you have a better capability for mobility. You can move more. You can identify more thermal refuge habitats, even though the water is warmer. If you can locate a cold water pocket in a warm water section, you can go back and forth between the two because the warmer water is actually a little more productive. There's more food there.
It's very interesting. And so, but all the rearing of rainbow trout is in the cold water because juvenile life stages are always more sensitive to temperature. And so it's kind of an interesting story. I'm realizing I need to move right along. These are just, again, these are some sort of tantalizing snippets into the thermal biology of the species. I'm not going to go into too much detail. Okay, so I talked about these trout and how they might use thermal heterogeneity differently. This is a thermal homogeneous reach, okay? And basically, there's no place, there's really no opportunity for a fish to move in and out of a cold water pocket to a warm water pocket. And so what we're hypothesizing is, well, maybe that's why the fish are smaller. Obviously, if you're big enough to utilize thermal heterogeneity, that's a good thing. And these are some hypotheses that we haven't actually tested with this study. We need to go in and do a different study. But it did really raise our question about these large fish that were caught in reaches where there was a cold water refuge that they could move in and out of. This study, there's a lot more that we need to do on it. I don't know what's going to happen if we get more funding to actually answer some of those questions, but it raised a lot of questions that are applicable to the thermal ecology of fishes in general. For example, you know, how do behavior and movement patterns, how do they change based on thermal heterogeneity at different spatial scales? And we also kind of need to know more about the physiology. There's been a lot of work on this done in Oregon, and there's, you know, we need a lot more kind of thinking about how, you know, what are the thermal tolerances and how does it influence growth? And finally, are there genetic differences actually between trout in the Crooked River in terms of their thermal tolerances and trout in a cooler river, like a portion of the Deschutes? And of course, how do all these things interact? There's lots of it's fertile ground for doing more research. And so I talked about fish behavior and how these fish use the thermal habitats differently. This is an example from Joe Ebersol's work where, see, the largest fish here is in the coldest portion of this pool. All the small guys are down here where it gets warmer. So obviously there's definitely a behavioral aspect to the use of thermal refugia where you've got all these small fish. They'd like to be here, but they're not because of the behavioral interactions. And, you know, we know that obviously these fish are, just because they happen to be located in a certain portion of the river doesn't mean that's where they'd like to be. No fish is an island, so to speak, and all these fish are having to battle it out amongst themselves in terms of getting food and using the colder water. So here's an example of juvenile Chinook in the Middle Fork of the John Day where their distribution is very patchy. They're most abundant right here. Well, that's not the coolest area of that river. It's cooler actually up here, and it's a lot cooler up here. But when we look at the habitat in this warm stream, we see that, there's the max depth sort of decreases in some of these in this peak where they're most abundant. This is the distribution of juvenile Chinook versus distance upstream, just like all the other graphs. So they're located in areas where the water depth is relatively low and the gradient's really high. Well, that's really strange. And we know that that's not where they'd like to be. Spring Chinook, if they could, like to be in the deeper water, the juveniles, and they like to be in a little slower water. So why would they be there? And when we look at the entire assemblage, we can kind of get a picture of why they're doing what they're doing. I'm not going to explain in sort of excruciating detail what this graph is. It's an ordination. It's just, for now, just recognize it as a way to help you understand how these different species are segregated with respect to multiple environmental variables, okay? The graph, what this means, you see this juvenile Chinook is in the upper left-hand corner of this graph. What that means is they're associated with high gradient reaches, shallow riffles, and they're really far away in terms of habitat space, if you will, from all these warm water species. So they're really isolated here. And don't worry about this. This is a little bit too complex to describe right now, but it just shows the variation in the assemblage structure versus distance upstream. But the key point here is that this, in this warm stream, the juvenile Chinook is locating itself in habitat that's not optimal in order to get away from a lot of these other species that would compete with it and prey upon it. Now, in a cool stream, and this is a hypothesis we tested, it's a completely different pattern. The juvenile Chinook are in deep pools, typically they're in areas where the water's a little bit slower, and they're more or less right within all these other species. Now, there are some warm water species here that they're not corresponding with. Now, I think for a lot of these fish species, the best place to be is at the head of a pool where there's a lot of food coming in, and always the species that is not able to compete best typically has to be in the faster water where there's less food. So in this cooler stream, all these warm water species tend to be in a different, they're sort of shunted off to this different part of the habitat. So this kind of gives you a feel for how all these species are interacting with one another in relation to thermal heterogeneity at this broad scale, but then that interacts with the habitat variation at the fine scale. So I talked about the potential trade-offs a little bit about the fish that is not in its preferred zone of thermal tolerance. They kind of tend to be shunted off to areas that are suboptimal. Well, in many of these cool water areas, the problem is that this is a rainbow trout or a steelhead. This may be cooler, but this is a really dangerous place to be. It's shallow, it's exposed, and there's a risk. Obviously, they're more exposed to bird predation by snakes, and so there's this complex suite of factors that these fish are having to deal with in order to exist in areas that are appropriate for their thermal zone of tolerance. And this is a graph that we came up with, or a conceptual flow diagram that just kind of shows all the different factors influencing a given fish, or the effectiveness of a refuge for salmonids during thermal stress. Obviously, you've got riparian canopy, within cold patch temperature range, the abundance of competing species of minnows, cyprinids, predation risk, the depth of that. So there are all these different factors that come into play when you're trying to understand whether these fish are going to use these cold water patches or not. So I'm going to wrap up and hopefully leave some room for questions, because I've kind of, again, given you a broad brush view of this theme of thermal ecology of salmonids. So these are some of the conclusions, just sort of take-home messages. So we learned that temperature alone can seldom explain fish distribution completely. Obviously, you've got to take into account habitat structure at multiple scales, at the microhabitat scale, the channel unit, reach, network, and basin level scale. And then there are also biotic factors, the other species that are there, the physiological tolerances of a given species, and taking into account predation and foraging and growth. And then finally, human impacts. Some of the areas that may be actually cooler, have been grazed, and there's no riparian vegetation. There's not that much food there. So it's a much more complex story, and that's sort of a general take-home message here, is that a refuge is not a home. We have to recognize that these fish are using these habitats in most cases because there's nowhere else to go. And we need to sort of maximize our ability to create the heterogeneity for these fish to go to if they need to use. But overall, we need to restore the complexity in the system to lower the temperature as a whole at the broad scale. So what can we do? There are a lot of questions and many different directions that one could go in this general field. There's a tremendous need for defining what a thermal refuge is exactly. And that's one of the things we're doing for the EPA, is coming up with some definitions and ways to quantify them. And again, I explained this earlier, temperature alone does not a refugium make. Obviously, you have to differentiate between thermal anomalies and thermal refugia. A thermal anomaly is just, you know, a relatively cool spot in the stream, but it may not be even usable by fish. And then we also have to recognize that these temperature patterns are changing through time and space. You know, I presented a very static picture, but you know, that's definitely not the case. These temperatures changing throughout the day. It's a really complex picture. And we really need to develop better statistical models that we can use to predict in both time and space. And finally, I think that, you know, this example of restoration in the Middle Fork of the John Day is a great example of experimenting and manipulating the landscape at a broad or riverscape scale, literally where we take a system, we study the heck out of it like I did in the John Day 10 years ago, and then we actually start restoring channel complexity, and we can see how temperature responds. And then, you know, this is a really important issue. I gave this a talk like this in Spain, and they really gave me a hard time because they said, oh, you Americans, you always just you throw a battleship at, you know, a very small project. They saw the helicopter and thought, oh, you guys are just, you got all this money. Well, the money, how we got it is a different story. No time for that here. But there is kind of, we need to bridge the gap between the technological haves and the have-nots. Obviously, some of these techniques are really expensive, but there are ways to quantify thermal heterogeneity that don't involve a helicopter. And you can learn about some of those on the website that I told you about at the Western Division AFS symposium. And then finally, sort of the new frontier is trying to understand how exotic species interact with native species, particularly in relation to climate change. Obviously, as the water gets warmer, we've got smallmouth bass that are going to move into the John Day farther upstream. And so there are these interactions among species is going to be really key to understand, because this could cause major problems, upsets, turnovers in assemblage structure.
And that's it.
I've left not very much time for questions, but I guess I'll stick around afterward or go in the hall and answer anything you got. So, thank you.
A couple of questions, maybe. So.
Yeah.
What is electrofishing?
Oh. Electrofishing is a method that you... Good question. Yeah. I'm used to giving this to fishery biologists. So you use a backpack with a battery, and electrofishing uses electrical current to stun the fish so that you can net them. And so it's a way you can just move a probe through the water, and the fish will actually turn belly up, be stunned, and hopefully not die. And then you count them and release them. Yeah. Good question. Anything else? Yeah.
What's sort of the goal of EPA locating? You're saying they're interested in locating these areas, but you said they're sort of dynamic and ever changing. So are they looking at delineating them?
That's why it's taking me so long to write this report. You can tell them. Is Drew here? The question was what is the EPA wanting to do with this information, and how are they going to try to quantify these thermal refugia, particularly if they vary through space and time? They're really difficult to pinpoint. And it's a great question, and I said that's why it's taking me so long to write this report, because it's pretty complex. But what the approach that we're taking is trying to describe habitat variability and sort of the physical template in relation to creating thermal heterogeneity in the system. So in a way, we're not going to be quantifying the thermal refugia themselves directly. In a way, we want to develop landscape characteristics that increase thermal heterogeneity. So and you can do that with modeling techniques as well. So it's definitely tricky, because you know the EPA, they need to set standards for water temperature. But a refuge is, you know, it's always changing, and we can define it in relation to water temperature surrounding, essentially, you know, what the temperature is in the thermal refuge at any given time, and what it is anywhere else, and say, well, it's a thermal refuge if it's 2 degrees cooler. The problem is that changes throughout the day. It's a refuge in the daytime when it's hot, but it's not at night. So it's definitely complex.
All right, so I guess we've run out of time. So thank you very much.